The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices. Conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. Joining us this morning on Campus Voices is Ashley Black, who will be on campus on September 21st as part of the university's National Agenda 2016 series, Road to the Presidency.
Hello.
This is just a crazy election season.
Is it?
How do you think none of the above would do?
You know, I think the narrative right now is that people wish it was anything other than these two people. But I have to say, I think there are a lot of people that love both candidates. And we're sort of talking about it as if that's not the case. But Trump has like 40% of the Republican vote. He's doing fine. People love Hillary Clinton. They're just not the people that the media is talking to, I guess.
That's interesting because sometimes you talk about the hidden voter or the silent majority, the phrase that used to get used. Both candidates have a large silent following.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's for the exact opposite reason, right? There are Trump voters who maybe they love what he says, maybe they kind of like what he says, but they don't want to be associated with maybe some of the bigotry or whatever. And then on the other side, there are these Hillary Clinton voters who are primarily women and people of color who just don't want people to be mean to them for their choice. So it's like one side is hiding from the other side, and who knows what the other side is hiding from.
I was reading, I think it was in Slate today, that Trump, like Romney, will probably win the white vote, but that Clinton, mm-hmm. like Obama, will probably win the college-educated white vote,
mm-hmm.
Along with the Hispanic and Black and Asian.
Yeah, college-educated might actually be the biggest divide in this campaign. We're talking about it a lot, like it's about race, but particularly among women. College education is pretty much the biggest divide between who's going Trump and who's going Clinton.
Wow, that's really interesting. Why would that be, do you think?
You know, it's difficult to say. I think we are overstating the extent to which Trump supporters are uneducated. There are a lot of college-educated Trump supporters. But I do think that making certain choices in life, whether it's going to college or even just leaving home for any reason to live in a different city or in a different state, kind of means you're already a pretty open-minded person or you're a certain kind of person. And those people tend to become more liberal, whether they start out that way or they leave their conservative family and move to a big city and become more liberal over time. There's just something about that ability to leave home that's like correlated to liberalness, I guess. I mean, I haven't like seen a study on it, but that's just my impression as a human.
It's really interesting to me to see how candidates package themselves. You know, of course, I'm so old that you know, I can remember the first TV debate, you know, with Nixon and Kennedy.
You know, it's funny, I cannot, but it's something I'd like always heard about growing up. And so recently I finally went back to watch it. And with like my eyes not, you know, being as immersed in the television of the time, it looks fine. It really doesn't look that bad. And I think my whole life it has been built up that like one candidate looked amazing and the other one was so sweaty and gross. And when you watch it now, it's like I can't really see the nuances of that in black and white. And it's funny that at the time it was such a big deal.
I think that your work with Samantha Bee, you guys really are having a field day with this election, aren't you?
I mean, in as much as you can. I feel like there's a very thin line between laughing and crying about things. So we try to cross that line every week as much as we can.
Well, during the Republican convention, you were part of a really funny piece. I don't think the people thought they were being funny, but were you and some of your other correspondents were trying to get attendees at the Republican convention to say Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, it was was really interesting. I think what I expected going in was that everyone would say all lives matter, and we just get a funny run of people refusing to say it. And what turned out was that we talked to a lot of people who had a lot of genuine emotion and were very conflicted about it. And it didn't come down to them not being empathetic or not caring. It actually came down to them having a lot of misinformation. Like, a lot of people truly believe that Black Lives Matter activists had killed a ton of police officers, which is not true, or that they were, you know, advocating for the overthrow of the government, which is not true. They had, somewhere along the line, whether it's from the internet or from cable news or whatever, they'd gotten some misinformation. And so these are people who, like, genuinely want to love everyone and don't want to be seen as racist and don't want to be racist. And they're, like, confused as to why people would support a movement that is doing these things that they've heard are being done that actually aren't happening. So it was, like, super interesting to talk to people and see how upset they were and how much emotion they had about something that, you know, isn't real, but they have every reason to believe it's real because some newscaster told them what it was. And it turned out to be much more conflicted than we went into it thinking it would be.
I'm wondering if this particular presidential cycle, there's more misinformation out there than in past years. Now, 8 years ago, of course, there were the birthers saying Obama wasn't born in America.
Which was brought to us by Trump, right? So I don't know if there's more or if it's being laid bare more in this election or if it's being more blatantly taken advantage of. Like, I think in the past there was like a wink and a nod to the idea that, you know, your chosen conspiracy site was putting some stuff out there and you weren't really going to acknowledge it, but if it helped you, fine. And with the introduction of Trump as a candidate, it's completely laid bare. And you have Rudy Giuliani saying, Google Hillary Clinton's health and you'll find. And what you'll find are like YouTube videos that individuals made that are not fact checks or based in any journalism or anything like that. But we've sort of gone away with the pretense of like putting that stuff out there and pretending that it's not tied to the campaign. And now, particularly with the Republicans, they seem really willing to just openly court those kind of conspiracy theories and stuff, which, I mean, I guess we'll see what the result of that is after the election. If Trump wins, then that will have been a winning strategy. If he loses, then maybe some people will take a look at the idea that maybe that is part of the reason why.
I think, you know, people talk about, well, any press is good press, and you know, PR people say you repeat something often enough, people will believe it. I just think that the sort of the short attention span of a lot of people leads to, like you say, people believing things that they've just keep hearing.
Yeah, and it's interesting, the few times that that doesn't work is like maybe instructive. Like, I know Chris Matthews did a really interesting piece about, I don't want to use a number because I'll be wrong, but I think it was something like 83% of Republicans really disagreed with how Donald Trump made fun of a disabled reporter. And that has actually been a huge driver of people to choose not to vote for him or to be conflicted about voting for him. So it's like there is a limit. Like, you can say Black Lives Matter is killing police officers and people are kind of okay with that. And you can say Hillary Clinton is secretly dying, but like, you can't make fun of disabled people. There is still a limit. So there's still hope. There are still things Americans are not okay with.
What do you think of all this talk about Hillary Clinton's emails?
I honestly can't care. And part of that is like I know if anyone ever went through my emails, there would be people who weren't happy with me, you know? So it's hard for me to like really care about that. I think what's interesting is there are some real scandals coming out of the Trump campaign. It's been revealed multiple times, but news outlets seem not to choose to pick it up, that he actually paid off an attorney general not to investigate Trump University. That's a huge deal. And that's not really mainstream information, and no one's really covering it. Or if they do, a lot of times the broadcast will frame it as, there's scandals on both sides. Trump paid off an attorney general, and Hillary sent some emails. and they're just weighing those as if those are equally weighted things. We've also been talking about the emails for, what, a year? And in that year, you know, 15 different Trump scandals have come and gone that got covered for 2 days, and then everyone forgot about them. But just the emails is able to, like, be a conversation for a year. So, you know, I guess there must be an appetite for it. I guess there must be people out there who really, really care about the emails, and it's really a wedge issue for them. It's hard for me to relate to just because I know no one I know's emails could stand up to scrutiny, I don't think.
I think it's people are looking for some reason they can hang their hat on something and just say, see how bad she is?
Yeah, because they don't like her. And, you know, it's like in your real life, and you decide you don't like someone, you're like, well, see, she's wearing a red T-shirt. I told you I didn't like her. Like, you're just looking for something. And in her case, I think it is people have gotten in the habit of disliking her. In the 90s, she was this incredibly divisive figure who was very ahead of her time as a public woman, and so people hated her. But the times have really caught up to her, and things that were like her saying she didn't want to bake cookies, that wouldn't be anything now. No one, there's hundreds of women out there willing to say they don't want to bake cookies, but people have just been in the habit of disliking her. So, you know, they'll hold on to anything to justify why.
I'm going to have to be very careful how I say this. Here we go. To me, with Donald Trump, there are certain parallels that I would draw between his campaign here in the 20-teens and the political campaign in Germany in the 1930s, where there was this character, oh, we don't need to take him seriously. And before you knew it, he was the Chancellor of Germany.
Yeah, and it's interesting. There have been a number of articles written that I think are really funny where people are like, you know what? We shouldn't have called so many other people Nazis, because now that it's really happening, we've lost all credibility with that comparison. And it's kind of true. Like, it's been, we've been so hyperbolic about our politics that people have learned to just ignore the media when they say something is a big deal. And so now nothing's a big deal. It's all screaming all the time. So how do you differentiate between something you're really supposed to be afraid of?
I'm really glad you mentioned that, the hyperbole of politics. I mean, to me, that's one of the things that's happening is we're getting polarized by all the hyperbole that we're all shouting at each other.
Yeah, everything's the end of the world. Obamacare was going to be the end of the world. You know, so how do you, if the end of the world actually happens, how are we going to discuss it?
Well, us Democrats will blame the Republicans, and the Republicans will blame us Democrats.
And everyone will cross their arms and stare across the room blaming each other while it catches on fire, right?
Yeah, I think that sounds like the plot of a bad science fiction movie I watched one night on. No, but seriously, I think that the polarization and sort of the skimming the surface with social media and short news stories, I think those have really helped exacerbate the tension between the sides this time.
Yeah, and we're also at a point where it's very easy to only get the news that you want. So it's very easy to go unchallenged in your assumption or your belief, because you can actually never hear the other side of the argument, let alone hear it and decide to dismiss it. You can actually never have heard it in the first place. And I don't know how you can have a democracy if we aren't having a conversation that involves everyone at the same time. We're really having two completely separate conversations. And, you know, again, depending on the outcome of the election, if that makes some people want to make some changes, I've seen columnists on both sides sort of taking a certain amount of responsibility of, like, we definitely stoked this fire because it got us viewers and it got us clicks. And now we're realizing that we have created a post-fact economy where we can't get anyone to listen to us about the facts of anything. If they choose to change, you know, it'll be interesting to see. It's hard to imagine because obviously that style of journalism is a moneymaker.
As you were thinking about that and you said moneymaker, it reminded me of a news story I saw today. I think it was at the BBC website about how a lot of corporate giants like Pepsi-Cola are saying all the right things about climate change, and then they're funding research to try and debunk it.
Mm-hmm.
I think an awful lot of politics in the United States and Canada and Western Europe is tied to who's paying for it.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I got into a conversation with a cab driver the day after the end of the Democratic convention, and he was saying that, like, he felt like Hillary Clinton was going to lose because people are so fed up with government, and rightfully so, because government doesn't get anything done. And he was listing off his grievances with the government, and everything he listed off, I was like, oh, you know, those aren't actually things the government is in control of. Those are corporations making those choices. But we have such a, on both sides of the aisle, pro-business way of talking that we ascribe to the government a lot of problems that are actually problems maybe of capitalism or of corporations choosing to, for the example you use, choosing to cause a ton of pollution and then having a tiny, like, 1% of their company that's devoted to making commercials about how much they care about the environment or whatever. And yes, you could say, well, the government could make stronger laws or whatever, and it is unfortunate that they choose not to do that because they also have their funding coming from those corporations as well. But at the end of the day, we don't talk about the fact that the actors in this case is a business. It's not the government. The government's not pouring pollution into your neighborhood. It's a business, and the government is allowing it to happen.
I keep thinking that one of the reasons we've gotten into this mess is that the economy is so complex and all the interrelations between everything are so complex that not even the congressman knows what's going on, and the lobbyists have to write the bills.
And if they do know, they have no interest in explaining it to us in that way. Like, our media very much rewards a three-word phrase. And so even the politicians that maybe do have a very nuanced understanding, they can't get elected unless they boil it down to three words for us that can become a hashtag.
Now, this was before my time, but the way Adlai Stevenson talked about in 1952 was he was disgusted that he was being marketed like a tube of toothpaste. You know, there's so many things going on, and you're going to be here coming to campus and talking about the whole environment in which this election is happening. And one of the things I just wanted to ask you about was the whole kerfluffle around Colin Kaepernick. That is wild. It's free speech, folks.
Yeah, turning that into an issue about veterans is, like, on the one hand, it's ridiculous because it obviously has nothing to do with that. On the other hand, it's genius, and I don't know who these people are, but somewhere on the right are these really genius people who take something that is just blatantly, nakedly racism, and they find the perfect package to put it in so that you can happily carry it around. And you know what it is a lot of people just don't want to see black people talking about oppression. They don't want to see black people protesting. They like the status quo, they like the way it is, and they don't want to be reminded that there are people who are hurt by that status quo. But you sort of can't, in polite society, say, I wish black people would be quiet and just play football. And so someone comes up with a great thing of, like, he's disrespecting veterans, and now everyone can freely say that that's their issue. And, you know, it's been great watching veterans come forward and say, of course we fought for everybody's right to say whatever they want to say, because that's what America is. One of my, like, personal pet peeves is that people don't understand what free speech is. I see a lot of people online going, oh, if you don't respond to my tweet, you are stopping me from having free speech. Or if my boss won't allow me to wear this T-shirt at work, it's a violation of my free speech. And it's like, that's not what free speech is. Free speech is that the government can't stop you from speaking. It has nothing to do with only people who agree with me are allowed to speak or anything like that. And so it's been, you know, it's been great to see veterans respond because they understand it, because they are the people who have gone out and fought for it. But also, why were they dragged into this conversation that has absolutely nothing to do with them?
I think nationalism is, you know, I'm proud to be an American and all, but I think nationalism is another one of those isms that can be very divisive.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's what I take this as, is like, well, he's different from me, and I'm going to choose to say he's violating my understanding of what it means to be American.
Yeah, and I find the majority of appeals to nationalism very disingenuous. Like, it's very easy to be proud to be an American without hating any other American. Actually easier.
And if you look at the economy, we're in a global economy. I drive a Subaru that was assembled in Indiana with parts made in Mexico and Taiwan, and the head offices are in Japan.
Because it's so cynical that, like, as that person who lost their job making auto parts, of course you have every right to be upset about that and to petition your government to address that in some way. But it's not that person. There's someone five levels up who's telling that person. And you know whose fault that is? Mexicans. Get mad at them, as opposed to addressing the actual issue, which is that maybe we need to make some education changes so people are trained for jobs that are available, or whatever the real issue is. Instead, we're going to yell at each other about which brown people are the worst today.
Which brown people are the worst today? You know, there was a time it was the Irish everyone hated. But you couldn't always tell who was Irish and who was Italian.
Yeah, this is a lot easier.
Well, we're joking around about these things, but they're serious topics. And to me, things like people screaming about Colin Kaepernick, or who's the soccer star who's now doing this now, Megan Rapinoe, I mean, doing this, or the other one that really gets me is people screaming about where our transgender children are going to go to the bathroom. These are all things that people are, in my opinion, screaming about to distract people from the real issues.
Yes, interesting. I had a really great conversation with a woman who was very upset about the transgender bathroom issue. And her whole thing was like, I want my child to be safe, and someone is telling me that they might not be safe, and shouldn't we do something about that? And I, like, you know, it's very hard to, like, not get frustrated with people and immediately start yelling. And I actually said to myself, I'm going to take this opportunity to practice being patient and really engage with this person and not immediately, you know, call them a bigot or whatever. And so I asked her, you know, in your entire life, have you ever known anyone to have an issue going to a bathroom with a trans person? No. And I say, well, you believe me when I tell you that has actually never been a known issue. There have been no reported instances of a trans person attacking someone in the bathroom. Okay, sure, I believe you when you say that. So why do you think that we need to pass a law to stop people from going to bathrooms if it's never been a problem? And, you know, we got to the point where we had, like, a very productive conversation, and she realized that her fears were, A, unfounded, and B, had been stoked by someone who had an agenda other than keeping her child safe. But unfortunately, you know, how long would it take for someone to have that 30-minute conversation with every individual person? It's so easy for one person to get on the news and yell that your kids aren't safe. And if it's something that emotional and that real, of course people are going to believe it and become worried. And there's no one out there who has the time and the ability to go door to door and knock on their doors and go, hey, I know that guy looks like he knows what he's talking about because he's sitting behind a desk on the news and we're supposed to believe those people. But, you know, he's actually saying that to you because he's trying to help get someone elected who made a lot of huge economic mistakes in your state. And he doesn't want you to focus on the economics. He wants you to focus on an issue that you can vote for him on. So he's lying to you and telling your kids are unsafe. Like, who can? It's so much easier to just go, your kids aren't safe, your kids aren't safe, and get people's attention.
And people are all too willing to confuse an emotional response with something resembling, oh, that must be a fact.
Yeah. That feels right.
But that's why I feel like a lot of these things that people are saying, the political rhetoric, actually on both sides of the aisle, or like this transgender issue, they're trying to say things to foment division.
Yeah, because you're going to keep clicking on that site. You're going to keep watching. They've monetized that. And also, that division, it snowballs on itself, right?
Yeah.
You tell a group of people, these group of people are against you, and then what do? They go and they argue online, or they have confrontations in real life, and then you film that confrontation. You put it on TV and you say, see, I told you there was a problem with these people, and they're creating the problem and then reporting on it.
Self-fulfilling prophecy. Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you have said is that you think that comedy can be a force to promote empathy and maybe diffuse some of these things.
Yeah, I think that in order to, so actually there's been research, and when you watch someone perform something, if you watch a play or a TV show or a dance, you are actually exercising the same neurons that you would be as if you were doing it yourself.
Oh, wow.
So when you watch a character go through an experience on like a very small level, you're actually experiencing it. And in comedy, in order for comedy to work, you have to empathize with that character or else it isn't funny. So like when you see a character get yelled at by his boss and he's embarrassed, your tiny feeling of embarrassment that you have and empathy with him is actually what allows you to laugh. You laugh to release that feeling. And so it is practicing empathy on the smallest, most basic level. And for me, myself, as a Black woman, it used to be very much so, and it still kind of is rare to see Black women as the leads in stories, as the person that you're meant to identify with. And so in order for me to make comedy, I have to make you identify with me, which means I have to make you identify with a Black woman. And so you are practicing something that maybe you wouldn't get the opportunity to do in your everyday life if you don't know a lot of Black women or if you're not primed to identify with them. And so it is, you know, like comedy can be seen as like so silly and so meaningless. But for me, even if I'm not explicitly talking about politics, like I do a lot of sketch comedy. If I'm doing a sketch that's just about a woman living her life, it has nothing to do with politics. Just the act of you identifying with me and seeing something through my eyes is a political act, because we're very primed by media to have that experience through white men, but not as much through anybody else.
That's really profound. I think that insight will be something that the students here will really enjoy hearing from you when you come to campus on September 21st for the Road to the Presidency, the National Agenda series. What do you think your message is to college students about this election?
Yeah, I used to teach college students, and every class I ever taught, no matter what the topic of it actually was, would at some point have the same message, and it'll be my same message there, which is question everything you consume. There is no media that's just entertainment. There is no media that is not in some way political. And we have to be questioners of our media. And I would even take my students through, let's talk about a movie that everyone's seen and everyone loves that we think is just funny and great. And let's look at the gender politics, the racial politics, the whatever behind this media. And a lot of times you don't want to do that because it's like less fun. But, you know, you're a human being, just like the food you eat affects how your body behaves. The media you eat affects how you think and how you live your life. And I think if we've learned anything from this election, it's that Americans need to be better about questioning their media and looking for the biases that are inherent in it.
The students really enjoy getting the opportunity to meet people like you up close during part of the classic.
I hope so. The agenda, all the other speakers look so great. I was like, I hope they won't mind talking to a silly comedian for a day.
You are a very profound comedian. At least you were for the past 31 minutes and 25 seconds. Ashley Black, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.